Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This episode is made possible thanks to listeners like you. Want to support independent food radio? Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today.
Japanese. I'm your host Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I will try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Austin Power. He has been in the sake industry for the last 15 years as a sake sommelier and a kikizakeshi. And Austin currently works at Tokyo Record Bar in Greenwich Village and Nish Nish and the Special Club, both in Soho, all very popular spots in New York. And he also have a 10-year experience at the sake sommelier at Sake Bar Satsuko in East Village. And he's also a talented artist and a graduate of Parsons School of Design. So today we'll discover how Austin got into sake, how he convinces people to try sake even if they don't know anything about sake, and his fun sake dining pairing dinner parties, and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcaster. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Now let's start a conversation with Austin Power. Hello, Austin.
Hi.
So this is exciting. So I know how much you know about sake. So first of all, where are you from, and what did you eat when you grew up?
So originally I'm from Clinton, South Carolina, which is kind of a very small, uninteresting town in the north of South Carolina. And then for high school, I moved down to Charleston, which is a little bit more low country, kind of soulful style food. But mostly just a lot of really wonderful, fatty, beautiful southern cuisine, like Coca-Cola green beans and fatback and mac and cheese and roast and all of that beautiful stuff that's probably bad for you but tastes so good.
Yeah, so maybe you can start up here with sake.
Yeah.
So you are a sake specialist but also an artist. So what kind of art have you been working on?
So predominantly my practice has been concerned with portraiture. I love painting people. It's been kind of always been my passion, starting from drawing kind of caricatures and cartoons and things when I was little, and then moving on to some more serious oil painting, and then landing really through like the fault of getting mono and not being able to stand up and make these giant oil paintings. I started making watercolors of all the people in my life I was too ill to spend time with. So that became the work that really got quite successful for me and helped me to investigate my personal relationships and really find, like, articulate my love for people.
Right. And I went to your website. I love watercolor, even prefer to oil. And I found this statement. So this is fascinating. I am interested in showing the difficulty and discomfort in fully understanding a person. I leave my subjects incomplete to highlight their limitations, as well as my own inability to see the subject beyond the influence of myself. So what do you mean by this?
So that's kind of the artist statement I landed on to try to explain what I was making. And I lived in France for a year to study abroad for school. And I learned French in my very country southern high school. And they said, oh, your French is perfect. It was not. And so that was my first experience really being disassociated from my language skill. And then also realizing how much I relied on humor to connect with other people. And I kept thinking, what do these people think of me? How do they perceive me? What memory am I leaving when this big portion of my personal value is missing? And of course, you can't ever know that, because even if somebody tells you, they're probably going to be nice about it, you know? but what I could do is make these impressions and these evocations of how I was experiencing all of the people in my life that I love, even though my work is kind of sometimes described as spooky. But in my joke about the South is that people in the South have two emotions, happy and joyful. And then the rest of it, you kind of keep to yourself. So moving to New York and meeting people from all kinds of different places and cultures, I became so fascinated by people who could really wear their emotions.
I don't hear happy and joy here so much. We do too. But it's interesting, right? It's like you can't, probably even if you have perfect common language, you don't understand the other person.
Right.
You'd imagine you do, but people, everybody's changing every day in a way.
We're different every day. And also different people mean different things. My grandfather on my dad's side, when he passed away, so many people that were at the wake, everybody had such a different characterization of him because of the role that he played in their life, or a coworker, or a friend, or boss, or a grandfather, or, you know, his parents were passed away, but he was a child to someone. And all of those different things come with a different weight and a different accessibility. And so I just try to encapsulate like what these people mean to me and how I see them in that moment. And so the portraits aren't just to say, this is who this person is, which is what strict oil painting felt like to me. It seems to want to represent a person in their full richness, which is kind of impossible. But through repetition and repainting and repainting these people, I can create a moment about our relationship together.
Interesting. Probably your painting is creating the subject's self-image as well. So yeah, this everything's so interactive. Okay, so now let's talk about your career as a sake professional. And how did you get into Japanese sake?
So my freshman year at Parsons, my first friend, Caroline Taylor's wonderful kind of curator and art advisor now, she's from Alabama, so we both had these insane southern accents. And then our third friend, Kazuya Shitake, was from Osaka, Japan. And we were like three musketeers.
And Osaka is from the dialect too. So.
Yes. And so we're all hanging out together. And at the end of our freshman year, he took us to Sake Bar Decibel, very special place. And a big Ishobin came out to the table. And I thought,
oh, listen, so Ishobin is 18 milliliters, huge bottle, right?
1.8 liters, just really a big boy. And it did not leave. It stayed on the table and we drank the whole thing. And we got, you know, marvelously tipsy. And that was my first real experience with sake, which was also enjoyed with two people who were immensely important to me and who I love very much. And that's kind of been the story of my sake career, is drinking sake with people I love. I highly recommend it.
Right. Oh, that's a very important moment. Mm. So do you remember what label you had?
So I was trying to think which one we were having. I feel like we were having Wakatake.
Okay.
Onikoroshi, Daiginjo. Mm. A little bit of lavender. Very just like pretty. But I might have made that up.
Just because you didn't remember.
That sake has followed me through my career, it seems.
Ah, really?
Yeah. It just keeps showing up places. Yeah.
Interesting. So it's going to keep leading you to somewhere.
Right.
Right. Awesome. But you visited the brewery?
Nope.
Yep.
I haven't been yet.
Oh, maybe that's the beginning of the conversation.
Yes.
Awesome. So you like the sake, but you cannot just start your career as a sake professional. So right. How did you start it?
So all of my whole life has been a wonderful accident of being tipsy at the right times with the right people. So
that's the key, right? With the right people.
With the right people. So one of my best friends, some people call her my sake mama, but really, even though we have an age difference, we're just really kind of the same people. So it's Satsuko Watanabe of her bar, Sake Bar Satsuko, which opened the same month that I moved to New York, but it took me 4 years to meet her. And we met at a mutual friend's party. And I started hanging out at the bar and we were having a lovely time. And then one day we were drunk at brunch. One of her bartenders didn't show up for work and she said, "I'm old, you do it." So that's how I became a bartender.
Wow.
I already knew everything because I'd been drinking there, for a year at that point. Or not everything, but I knew a little bit about everything.
Mm.
And that's how I got started. And then through Satsuko, I ended up meeting a very cherished friend of mine and one of my art collectors, and he was a sake enthusiast. So he would take me out every time we'd hang out. We would drink sake together. And I was drinking sake that was much fancier than my kind of 21-year-old self was.
Right. Thank you.
Had any business drinking, but I got to see a large breadth of sake at a really fun, integral time in my life. And so he had a philosophy of drinking sake, which is also a fun way to do this. When you go out drinking with someone, you read the list and the descriptions, and you choose the sake that sounds like the person you're with, and that's what they have to drink. So it's a way to try things you wouldn't normally have, and it can either be very flattering and very cute, or kind of, funny and catty,
Wow, that's a very key advice to any sommelier, right? Yeah. And when you write a wine list or sake list, you have that personality in the bottle.
Yes.
Yeah, that really makes sense though, right? In your mouth, that's what you eventually find that personality.
Yes.
Yeah. So do you write your sake list like that?
I have actually never done the descriptions.
Okay.
At any of the places that I worked. I have my own way of speaking about them while I'm there. I think mine would maybe be a little too esoteric.
I want to read that though. Yeah. Right. So, so you spent 10 years at Sake Bar Satsuko. So what is the concept of Sake Bar Satsuko?
So Satsuko is a really special place. Before I started working there, every bartender who had ever been there was a musician, just because she loves music and those were the people she was meeting and connecting to. And I was the first visual artist, but everyone who works there is a very creative person. And then I just found a deep love and connection for sake in the community. And so even though I left a number of times, I kept coming back. It was kind of always been my home base. And it's a very special, small style restaurant. I love small restaurants because really just kind of rude people can't handle a small restaurant.
Mm.
It's too intimate. So the customer base, the people who came there were all just at the very least nice and at their best, wholly worldly and interesting and just a real treat to get to know.
I haven't been, so I have to be there.
Yeah, it's very fun. And it's a mother and daughter. Satsuko's daughter, Amy, was born and raised in New York. So her experience of Japanese cuisine and Asian cuisine and cooking it is really influenced by all of the people that she grew up around here in New York. So it's a lot of times people call it very unconventional, which is a nice way of saying wild, like hot mess. They make the food that they want to eat. Mm. If we don't want to eat it anymore, we don't make it anymore. And a really special sake list, and usually somewhere in the range of about 50 different styles and varieties. And it really is very unpretentious. You just gotta, the rules are just come and be fun.
Mm. So I'm curious though, that kind of conventional flavor offers probably opportunities for you to pair with interesting sake.
Absolutely.
Right.
And it's kind of a place where drinking, the food menu has really changed and evolved over the years. But when it began, it was really at its core, very izakaya. Like the food was there to keep you from getting too drunk, but the star was always the drinking. And so I have always been leading with sake first and food second in my career. And I think that, you know, drinking is fun and sake is delicious and you should absolutely have it. But it created a wonderful opportunity to just get people to try new things and really enjoy drinking something in the place with the people.
I think you said one day you drink irresponsibly. That's your
Yeah, so that is 100% my philosophy for sake, is that the thing missing from sake culture in America is that people aren't drinking sake irresponsibly enough. You should 100% get wild. Right. It's a very lovely drunk.
Oh, you see that all the time in Japan. Yeah. Yeah. So, well, I think you should do that at least once.
Yes.
Okay. And so you, what did you learn from the experience at Sakeba Satsuko?
What didn't I learn? I don't, so many things. Wow. It was really, the customer base there is quite special because either people know nothing about sake or they know way too much. They're so overly engaged. So you really get to nerd out and really just follow your bliss and talk all of these super technical intricacies of the sakes, or you just get to help people get ripped up, you know. And Satsuko is one of the... They really celebrate the sake bomb, which is very taboo. one of my friends affectionately calls me the sake bomb sam, because I think I'm the only kikizagishi in New York who likes to do them. But
I've never seen it in my life, actually.
Yeah, it's very silly. It's dinner and a show.
Okay.
That type of like fun kind of party atmosphere is something that I think is really special and helps people really connect and engage. And I find that people go out and seek sake on their own and they bring it to parties. And I had a lot of customers who are now like family to me because we've known each other, and I've watched them grow up and go from being a 21-year-old who was ready to party to like maybe someone who needs to be in bed by 11, you know. And so watching people really grow into themselves and change was a real blessing.
Interesting. Wow. So sounds like it's a very family kind of, like almost not a dining establishment, more like family.
Yeah, it's a cult for sure. It's just
wow.
Once you get hooked, you're stuck with it.
Okay. So it's listeners, Sakeba Satsuko in East Village.
Yes.
All right. So now you work at Tokyo Record Bar, Nish Nish, and Special Club, all with Ariel Asi. She's fascinating, talented. Yes. Beverage professional.
Yes.
And so first, could you tell us this concept of Tokyo Record Bar and what sake you serve there?
Yeah, so Tokyo Record Bar is a 7-course tasting meal. We have vinyl records all around. So if you come for the 7-course tasting, we have a vinyl jukebox with song selections from our collection, and each guest gets to choose one song, and our DJ makes a live curated playlist. So really the room is directing the music and the vibe, and you get to kind of have this communal dining and listening experience. Our sake list is about 18 to 20 sakes at any given time. And Ariel's twist on it is to give them each a nickname based on a tasting profile. So it's a way of kind of helping to explain aroma to guests that maybe are less familiar with sake, based on her knowledge and experience doing the same thing for champagne.
For listeners who are not familiar with record bar in Japan, it is a Japanese culture.
Yes.
Like old classic, like kiseten, you know, Japanese cafe. It's just something very cult about having a vinyl on play in classic style. So I think you can find some good vinyl, like a jukebox store, like a restaurant or bar in Japan, right?
And Ariel's always loved music, and really music plays a strong role in each of her restaurants. Like Special Club is our newest one that just opened 3 weeks ago, but that has a live band playing, and the band's changed throughout the week. But really, dining and speaking and being involved intimately with music as a star of the experience, but also not to be revered and quieted in front of, to really be interactive and to sing and to dance and to just feel that joy of eating and drinking and music.
I really like the concept of Tokyo Record Bar and Special Club, because it's like building a community. It's maybe something similar to Sake Bar Satsuko.
Yeah.
But there's a communal element and celebrate something, the occasion of it.
Yeah, and it's a really special experience for people, I think, to be able to have a part in the evening that they're creating. And then also, there's a big portion of the restaurant group that is also letting go of control of the situation. We give you something to choose, but most of it you really have no control over. So it's really to put yourself in our hands and let us make a special evening for you.
Wow. So honestly, I haven't been to any of those, but I'm now really into it. So so that kind of environment, you know, the Tokyo Record Bar and Special Club, they're not, I'm going to ask you about Nishinishi in a second, but the two places, at least, they're not Japanese food place at all. So how do you, you know, what kind of sake are you offering? Thinking of, you know, different mindset from pairing with Japanese food and Western style cuisine.
Yeah, so Tokyo Record Bar, the food there is Japanese inspired, but also has evolved as we've been open. We're about to hit 2 years being open, and it's really more controlled by the markets in New York. The chefs go shopping every morning at 10. It's really what they cook is what they have for the night. So everything's super fresh and really local, but I think that's also kind of a very strong presence and concept in Japanese cooking as well.
Right.
Fresh ingredients and letting the ingredients drive your food and presentation. When looking at sake list in general, I try to be mindful to have something for everyone. I always think, which maybe isn't the typical approach, but I always think sake first, like as a standalone. And in terms of pairing with food, like there are certain notes there and things that sing together, but I'm more concerned personally with the palate of the individual and what's going to heighten their experience and what they're going to enjoy most and learn from most while they're drinking sake. Because I think with guests who maybe don't have a lot of sake experience, that first glass to really try to convince someone is quite key and important, and you want them to have a good memory. I also, a number of years ago, had a head injury that affected my sense of smell. So I lost my sense of smell for almost 3 years.
Wow.
And then it all came back, which was lovely. But through that and that disparity, I learned to focus a little bit more also on like body weight and texture. And I think that there's a disconnect when we're talking about beverages and choosing what's going to be best for someone between the weight and the texture and the aroma. Sometimes people, generally speaking, describe what they want based on aroma, but they're not thinking about all of these other beautiful factors. So you can really find something surprising and delicious if you can deduce all of those details.
Right. Yeah, one thing that comes to mind is the mouthfeel and how long it lasts long if it's viscous, and it's a big element.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, reminds me of Grand Katz of Chicago. He lost his, the palate after the tongue surgery, that kind of thing. So talented people really make it as a springboard to make it better.
Yeah.
So, okay. And so let's talk about Nish. So it's a very unique program, right, you have?
Yes. And Nish is also that idea of the beverage driving the meal. Each night of the week, Monday through Friday, we have a different host from the beverage community who comes. They make four selections for what you're going to drink.
Basically, there are sommeliers. Sommeliers,
importers, winemakers, wine writers, sake sommeliers, producers, all of these wonderful things. So we really don't limit who the guests are. They just have to love drinking and do it somewhat professionally, you know? That's not even a prerequisite. Actually, they just have to love it and be knowledgeable. Mm-hmm. But each night, there's a different host. They make four selections on what to drink, and they give us those at least 2 weeks in advance. And then based on what they've chosen, the chefs make a four-course dinner to pair with the beverage selections. Mm. So it really is drinking first. Food second, and it's kind of a dinner party vibe. Everyone arrives at the same time. You get a little introduction. You can learn as much or as little as you want. We kind of walk around the room and we tell you in detail about what you're drinking, but if you don't care, you don't have to. You can just enjoy yourself. And if you want to know all the nitty gritty, we will all get very, very nerdy with you as well.
What's fascinating to me is that's kind of wine and sake tend to be viewed as competitors, but now sake and wine world started to be more kind of merged into each other because of, I think, a lot of sommeliers are more into learning about sake.
Yes.
Sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes not.
Yeah.
But so then you have the same stage, right? Mm. To work with sommeliers and wines and...
Yes. And certain hosts have mixed and matched. So we've tried to do 1 to 2 sake dinners at Nish per month, but some people have mixed the two together to give different coursings. And I was lucky enough to get to do a sake pairing dinner there as well, which was quite fun and very special, especially for the guests who were not aware it was going to be a sake evening.
Oh, that's funny. All right. Okay. Well, let me ask you first. I want to talk about that dinner. The special club, it's a music club, and, that's not something like you'd expect sake, right?
Yes.
But you decided to put it there. So I just want to see how people react to sake in a kind of unusual, unexpected space.
We're number one. We, as a restaurant group, just myself and Jessica Jolie, Misake USA, we both love sake so much. Mm. So it seemed remiss not to include it.
Nice.
And also Special Club is named after the Special Club champagnes, really beautiful vintages. So we have a number of those on the list. And for our sake selections, we tried to pick very interesting leaning style sake, something that you might not have somewhere else, or that maybe might be a little out there for someone's everyday sake list. So we have a really beautiful Kamazumi from 1997. It's a 22-year-aged, really gives some beautiful whiskey tone. Mm. We serve that upper on the rocks. We have kind of a highball cocktail, but made with Nambu Bijin's All Koji.
Mm.
Which has a very beautiful present flavor. Yuzo Kuji's Yuzo Special. He's the younger brother from Nambu Bijin. And that one is one of my personal favorites right now. It's like if Mugicha was alcoholic. It's just so special and savory. And
Well, can I ask you that? So the two questions. So one is a 22-year-old.
Yes.
Super koshu, right?
Old. Yes.
Okay, so how does it happen? It's like people over 3 years is called koshu, right?
Yes.
And 22 years.
So
yeah, it was my first time seeing it once it showed up on the list there, but it's just surprisingly delicate and balanced, and you don't get as much of the viscosity and weight that you might expect from a 22-year aged koshu, but really beautiful developed amber color. And for someone who's maybe looking for a whiskey or a bourbon, which we don't offer distilled spirits at any of our restaurants, they can really have a very surprising engagement and get some of those deep, earthy, nuttier tones from these beautiful aged koshus.
Wow. Which brewery made it?
That one is by Kamazumi.
Okay. Kamazumi. I'm a big fan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're fabulous.
I visited their place too. So you said all koji. So what do you mean by that? By
definition? So Nembubijin's all koji is a sake, but made completely with the kojimai, the koji inoculated rice. And they call it all koji.
There are two types of rice used in sake. And the one is a steamed mushimai, and the kakemai, and the kojimai. So that means like it's much sweeter.
Yes.
Rice, right? Because it's
because
not
the starch is being broken down into the sugar by the koji. And they also sometimes have a little bit sweet, but also kind of a chestnut tone and really some beautiful flavor. So it's called all koji because you can't legally call it sake if it's all kojimai.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
There's Chizuko Ninawa Hilton was telling me she was visiting a brewery who was making a sake 99% kojimai. They put one grain of steamed rice in it. She was like, why one grain? But that's because for the legality to call it sake, they have to have at least one grain of steamed rice. It's very interesting.
Interesting. Yeah. I really want to try this. I've been just talking about koji for the last, I don't know how many episodes, but yeah, I know the power. So very interesting. Right. And so what is the philosophy of selecting and serving sake? Like, you know, do you have anything in your mind, regardless of where you are?
I always want there to be something for everyone on my list. And by everyone, I mean whatever their go-to spirit is. When I'm meeting customers for the first time, I generally say, what do you like to drink in life booze-wise? Because you can ask someone what they want, but we all get confused with words. The word dry needs to just be buried. It really means nothing now. Everyone says it. And so there's no universal tone for that. But if I can get a sense of what people typically are drinking, then I can make a deduction based on what type of like body weight, flavor profile, what they're open to in terms of richer, bolder flavors, or if they want something more delicate and dialed in. So I always approach in that way. And I think to give someone a note, especially about a sake, what terms they can think of it in, based on beverages they might have had more frequently, that's a really nice way to open their mind to the flavors and textures they're experiencing, and then also get them to retain a little bit of the information.
So it sounds like you open up somebody's interest rather than educate, try to teach them.
I try to teach them very sneakily.
That works usually.
You learn, but you don't know you're learning. Yeah.
That's the best.
Yes.
Yeah, I wish all my teachers are like that. Okay, so now let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about challenges and solutions in serving and educating sake for Austin. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by you. As an independent, member-supported nonprofit, the amazing content you hear on Heritage Radio Network is made possible thanks to our generous community of members and partners. For 10 years, HRN has been a defining voice in America's food movement, and we never would have made it this far without you. Join us in celebrating an amazing decade of food radio and support our summer fund drive by becoming a member of HRN. You can choose from our member gifts and will receive exclusive discounts on HRN events. We truly believe that with your help, we can change the world and our food system one bite or soundbite at a time. But there's no food radio without you. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate before July 31st to do your part to ensure a bright future for your favorite food podcasts.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from the studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Austin Power, who has been in the sake industry for the last 15 years as sake sommelier and kikizakeshi. And Austin currently works at Tokyo Record Bar in Greenwich Village, Nishinish, and a special club, both in Soho, all very popular spots in New York. So I asked you about the philosophy, but what's your biggest challenge in offering sake?
For me, and this comes back a little bit to my idea that we should be drinking sake more irresponsibly, the number one thing I hear from guests, no matter their sake experiences, I really don't know that much about sake. Okay. I know a ton. You're in luck. You came to the right place, right? But I think that we spend so much time and energy educating that we've created a very unique issue where the boundary becomes in people's heads. Like, oh, I don't know enough about this to appreciate what I'm drinking. And so my response to that is, well, the most important thing about drinking sake is to get it in your mouth. Mm. You know, it's right. just drink it, have a good time. And when we're looking at other beverages, you really don't see that issue with liquors or, wine. Sometimes maybe people feel that way, but typically speaking, you just drink. You don't have to ask the question.
Mm.
How much do you know about most alcohol you drink?
Mm.
It doesn't stop you from enjoying it.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Before I started this show, I don't think I much too much about sake.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah.
And so usually though, if you don't know anything about anything, it's you're reluctant, right? So what the hell is this?
Yeah.
So how do you make that kind of push to convince them?
When I'm getting people ready to drink sake, maybe for the first time, the number one thing is I'm a big fan of bullying. I really will try to drive them away from another choice and bring them to somewhere in sake that I know they're going to enjoy based on what they've told me they like. I'll get them to taste something and say, you know, if you don't like it, feel free to splash it in my face. It's fine, you know, and just really lighten the mood and get them engaged to try something new and have a good experience. And then after that, it is a little bit about sneaking education in, explaining to them what sake is. I think a lot of people misunderstand. They think sake is distilled or that it's at a higher alcohol point than it actually sits at. And so I try to dispel those things for them.
Mm. Right. I don't know what's the proportion of people who don't know much about sake, but do you think it's like the majority, even in New York City?
I think that I think people have had an experience with sake. We have like two problems that I run into. My favorite customer is the person who says, I don't really like sake. So I say, when was the last time you had it? Was it free? Were you in a mall? Who hurt you? Like, why do you have this bad feeling about sake? What did it do to you? And so maybe they just had something that was confusing or was pleasing or just it wasn't connected to their palate and what they enjoy. And to show them that there's such a vast array of flavors and profiles and experiences you can have in sake.
Mm-hmm.
And usually people loosen up a little bit by that one.
Just forget about the horror stories.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's one thing as professionals that we really need to lean into is create trust with our consumer base so that they will have faith in you and believe in you to take them somewhere that they maybe weren't sure they were ready to go.
So as a sake professional, how do you think you can reshape the way people think about the sake or the lack thereof?
Right. I think, you know, the number one thing that's led me through sake has been drinking it in places I enjoy and with people I enjoy. So, you know, that's kind of a tall ask, but if we can create fun environments, if we can create engaging spaces for people to experience it and to drink it and to leave with a good memory, that goes a long way in wanting to repeat something or to make it a part of your life. And I've noticed a trend with customers that don't know about sake, but they want to learn because they're going to be traveling to Japan for the first time. So I think tourism is a really powerful tool as well, because they want to get something under their belt or to have a little bit more understanding before they embark on that adventure. And then once they can go and see, I would highly recommend that people visit, you know, just a brewery, go see how sake is made, because it's really such a beautiful, intense process. And once you kind of see the moving parts, you really understand the labor of love that it is, and can kind of understand also what it is that you're tasting, what is making this thing. And, you know, if you're in New York, go to Brooklyn Kura, go to Industry City, and you can see their koji room through the glass, and you can see the tanks and have that experience. But if you are traveling to Japan, go visit the breweries and see the places. They're so special.
Right. And even if they don't have time to do that, you know, izakaya, a lot of izakayas, their sake sommeliers are super passionate and confident proud of.
All just waiting to tell you all of the nerdy stuff we know. It's just, it's really the highlight of our day. So just ask.
Right. And then when they come back, though, they become a kind of more curious about sake, too.
Absolutely. Yeah. And bring more friends to have those experiences. And that's, you know, why Sake Bar Satsuko is such a powerful tool. I think creating spaces like that where people want to come back or have birthday parties, or and you see the friends who are confused. Where's my vodka soda? You know, but that's really the fun challenge, is to get them on board.
Right. Okay. So speaking of fun, so I want to hear about, you know, the dinner you mentioned earlier. So the nish, you did some fun memory producing special dinner.
Yes. So on the night that I got to host at nish, I chose four sakes, and my theme was sakes to be drunk in summer situations, which is both to be drunk as in drinking, but also to be drunk as in wasted. and the four that I offered that evening were Kirinzan Classic, which is a lovely futsushu. It's one of the first futsushu common sake to come onto the market here in New York.
Can you explain quickly what's futsushu versus...
Right, so we are normally thinking about the premium grades of sake, so Hanjozo, Junmai, Junmai Ginjo, Ginjo, Daiginjo, Junmai Daiginjo. Futsushu is sake that does not meet those milling ratio, those specifications. So sometimes called table sake, but essentially it just lives outside of the premium zone. But Kirinzan Classic is gorgeous. It's so light. It's the perfect sake to be drunk at the beach.
I heard sometimes, even if it's a seishu, like the premium class, some brewers prefer it to be called as futsushu. I don't know what, to be enjoyed more casually or something like that, right?
I think maybe so, yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So that's Kirinzan Futsushu.
Yes. So Kirinzan Futsushu to get started, the classic. The second that I served, I just lost all of my words.
I think they told me the Kozaimon.
Yes. Kozaimon, Junmai 65. Really gorgeous Junmai, a little bit of weight, nice bit of citrus. That one for me is like a martini with a twist. It's very classic. It's got a nice, strong bite to it. But it has a very distinct profile, but it's perfect for someone who really likes those more direct flavors. And that one was sake to be drunk on a boat. because it gives you all of those fancy, rich martini feelings, but you won't get so tipsy that you fall overboard. And then the third I served was Yuzukuji's Yuzu Special that we spoke about earlier, because it's just so lovely and really directly feels like it was made for me to drink. It's so savory, which we don't often think about savory beverages, but it's beautiful. And I served that alongside some southern barbecue, which is calling back to what I grew up eating. And to also give people sake against some cuisine that they wouldn't normally be drinking it with. And then we ended with Kikusui's Funaguchi, the gold can, which is like a wonderful boozy flower bomb. And comes in a little one cup style. So that was sake to be drunk anywhere you shouldn't be. So nice to sneak it in your bag or
drink it on the train. Can you explain about, you know, the culture of a one cup?
Yeah. I don't know a lot about the culture of one cup. I just, I heard from one of my friends the first time I saw one. And it was like, oh, that's for grandpas. Like that's what they drink on the porch.
You know, like in Japan, it's so open to drink sake in open space. So I remember, like, old man, you know, a little, you know, long distance train, to have a sake cup somewhere out of pocket and drinking and sipping, like, oh my God, that. But now I think that's there's a huge market of cup sake. It's a premium cup sake as well.
Oh, yes. And there's, yeah, there's really a lot of cup sake, which is a lovely way to travel or take it with you or picnic. Or
I had this Kikusui Funaguchi Namagenshu, and it was so good.
Oh, it's fabulous.
Yeah. So that sounds like a very memorable dinner.
It was great. People had a really lovely time. I had one table who said to me, what do we do if we don't like sake? And I said, oh, well, you're free to get over it. And they said, can you say that? I was like, I don't know, but I did. I'll go check. But they really gave it a try. And by the end, they had a really lovely time and said, you know, like, I, in no way is this what I thought I was doing this evening, but it really made for a special experience for them.
Well, I remember. I'll just say, just get over it.
Yeah.
I'm so glad. It sounds like a very successful dinner. So, okay. And, so is there anything in common between creating an art and educating about sake, or anything about sake and art?
So because I've been working with watercolor for so long and really like looking into handmaking paper, and there's a lot of tradition associated with labeling sake, which is going to be calligraphy and handmade paper and all of these labels. And water is so important to making sake. So I really... it's a life goal of mine to find a way to get all of these people in these industries where water is so integral, and to get them to investigate each other and really see the connection there, because the labors are very similar or interconnected. And I think that's just a very easy target group to get these artists obsessed with sake and the passion and the craft behind it. As well.
Well, you having said that, do you have any suggestions for sake producers who wants to come to the American market or anywhere overseas? Because that's crucial for them.
I don't.
Maybe.
I it's such a hard thing to think about all of the moving parts and how people associate. I know that there's a generally speaking, in wine shops as well, you know, labeling is so important to have something unique and eye-catching. But I was contracted to try to help make a wine label one time, and it's an incredibly difficult journey to make something that really serves all of the purpose you're asking it to make. So I just... am in awe, and you know, I say thank you to anyone who's taken on that job and really made these bottlings possible. But I think it's just the best thing you can do is to be strong in your resolve and your idea of what makes this unique and what makes this, you know, interesting, and why is it important that someone drink this? Because I think with any creative endeavor, you get into the trap of trying to please everyone, and it never works.
Right. And especially sake, well, anything in going to mouth is very personal. So right. It's up to the memories you have.
Yes. And I think, you know, what's great about how kind of the sake community and the industry is changing in New York is that we're having more and more opportunity. We're seeing more unique things being imported. And so we can really expand our palettes and our point of views and what the guest can have. But I would say my advice would be more towards the restaurants. Feel free to bully your customers into trying something great. You know, if you have something on there as a default or to placate, take it off. Don't give people the option for something easy. Always be interesting.
Right. Well, based on my experience with wine, when I'm pushed extra, I'm like, wow, thank you for that.
Yeah.
It's 100%, 100%. So, yeah, so I agree completely. Yeah, second that. All right, so what is your plan?
So I have a bunch of wheels turning. I'm trying to get more, and I'm trying to revive some of my art practice because I really stepped away to further my sake education. And now that I'm in a better place with that, I'm trying to get back to creating more creative content. I make silly shirts because I think clothing is such an interesting way to interact with others and also to invite the conversations that you want to have. And so to really just wear something loud and silly also as a service point is a good way to just let people know that they're in for something wild, that this is okay. It's okay to have fun. And to taste, and then hopefully I'll be going back to Japan sometime soon. I was just married.
Ooh, congratulations.
And so my husband's from Kyoto originally.
Oh, wow.
And so hopefully we'll get to go together and really experience. He's taken his sake advisor and kind of bullying him into getting further into the sake community, and so hopefully we can go experience.
And you picked the right husband because it's Kyoto is really one of the mecca of sake. Oh wow, awesome!
It's such a beautiful place.
Right.
So I'm just looking forward to learning more and meeting more people and making more silly things.
Yeah, well, it sounds like your keyword in your whole life is a conversation with people and culture.
Yeah.
So I love that. Thank you. So, okay, so where can we find your updates online?
So on Instagram, I am with a power because everything Austin Power was taken. But in this past year, I was lucky enough to finally get my website. So austinpower.com is where you can find me.
Beautiful artwork, too.
Thank you. And yeah, and otherwise, Tokyo Record Bar, Tuesdays and Wednesdays. After 10:30, we have a late night, which is a little bit easier to get into because the reservations are quite hard to come by. But you can come in and have a drink with me and talk sake.
Right. Yeah. Drink with you responsibly.
Yes, drink with me irresponsibly.
Yeah. Okay, so thank you for joining us today, Austin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so please, Miko, keep me posted. And maybe I can do, like, when you come back from Japan, you know, you can join me again and talk about the experience.
Absolutely.
Right. All right, so listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Engineer is Amanda, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org.
Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.